Ms. Cindy, the floor is yours.
Thank you. And thank you to all of you for joining us tonight on our teleconference on life and financial planning for LGBT older adults and older individuals living with HIV. I'm Cindy Horn, and I am the Director of Life Planning at Lambda Legal's National Headquarters. I will be moderating tonight's discussion. Tonight's call is part of Lambda Legal's Protect Yourself Tax, Life, and Financial Campaign, which has been graciously underwritten by the Anita Mae Rosenstein Foundation. Tonight we are joined by Lambda Legal Staff Attorney Natalie Chin, who has been leading our work on issues related to LGBT older adults and older individuals living with HIV. And we are also joined by Tom Siaka, a lawyer in private practice who specializes in life and financial planning for older adults. Tonight's call will last somewhere between 45 minutes and an hour, and we're going to start with Natalie Chin, who is going to give us a look at the legal landscape as it relates to LGBT older adults and older individuals living with HIV. At the end of the call, if we have time, I will take questions from you. So if you want to ask a question of our experts relating to LGBT older adults, you can send an email to libertycircle@lambdalegal.org, and we'll make every effort to address that question. Again, that's libertycircle@lambdalegal.org. Natalie, let's start by addressing some of the issues that have arisen when LGBT older adults and those living with HIV are accessing our health care system and how Lambda Legal is addressing these issues.
Okay. Hi, everybody. This is Natalie Chin. As Cindy said, I'm a staff attorney at Lambda Legal. I wanted to back up a little bit and kind of give a really brief overview on who we're talking about. Well, we're talking about LGBT older adults and older adults living with HIV. So depending on what statistics you look at, there's about 2 million older adults, 50-plus, who self-identify as lesbian, gay, and bisexual, and that's a 2010 study. In terms of people living with HIV, about 30% of people living with HIV in the U.S. are currently age 50 and over, but 70% of these people with HIV in the U.S. are over the age of 40. So what we're talking about is a really growing population, particularly that population of people living with HIV, because now it's a chronic illness and people are living very, very long lives. And that opens up a whole slew of legal issues that are unique to this particular population. Cindy asked sort of what are some issues around access to healthcare or the healthcare system. And what we're finding is that for LGBT older adults, and when I refer to older adults, I'm going to be talking about 50 and over, a lot of the issues are in terms of being denied access to long-term care or whether the doctors or healthcare providers are unaware of the special needs of LGBT older adults. There was a really wonderful study done recently last year by the National Center on Transgender Equality. And in terms of the number of trans older adults, unfortunately, there's not a lot of statistics out there. But what we do know is this particular population is very much a very large target for discrimination in the healthcare system. So just looking at this study for transgender older adults, it actually was 6,450 transgender people who were surveyed in this MCTE study, and within that, I'm not sure exactly how many were older adults, but the issues in that study are just as relevant to older adults. And what's really pretty amazing is that 50% of all of those people, so that's over 3,000 people, said that they had to take it upon themselves to teach their medical providers about transgender care. And that's really not acceptable, right? If you go to the doctor, you're already in a very vulnerable position. So this is an issue that is very relevant. And then Lambda Legal also recently did its own healthcare survey for LGBT people, and we took out the numbers to look at older adults. And in that survey, we found 70% of trans respondents and 63% of respondents living with HIV reported experiencing discrimination in the healthcare setting. So this is a very real issue of doctors and healthcare providers just, A, denying treatment outright, or being completely unaware of what the special needs are, as I said, for LGBT older adults. So I just want to break down a couple ways that Lambda Legal has addressed some of these issues, and I want to specifically refer to some of the cases that we've done. And Cindy, please, you know, stop me if I'm speaking too fast or if you have a question, we need some clarification on anything.
Okay. And if and for the audience, if you are having trouble following Natalie or you have some questions for her, if you will send an email to that email address, I can pass that along to her.
So I think one of the really important things as advocates or I don't know the different types of roles people are playing that are on this call, but I think it's really important to know sort of what are the legal rights of LGBT older adults in terms of accessing health care. What we found, and we've had a couple cases where we've had doctors deny treatment outright for a person because they're HIV. For example, we had this case, the Melody Rose case. It was out of Wisconsin. This woman was HIV positive, and she needed to get her gallbladder removed. And the doctor learned that she's HIV positive and said that he wasn't going to do the surgery because he was afraid of getting infected with HIV. And this is a very new case, and this is not very rare at all. Fortunately, we were contacted to help advocate on behalf of this person, and they got the treatment that they needed. But it is absolutely against the law to deny access to health care due to a person's HIV status. And this is a really good case to make that point. A couple other cases we had were doctors who denied access to health care because of their religious beliefs. And this is something we're seeing more and more. And I don't know, some people might know about the case in California. It's called the Benitez case. And again, some of these cases aren't specific to LGBT older adults, but the issues that are presented in these particular cases are absolutely relevant to LGBT older adults. So this Benitez case in California, this woman wants to get health care for reproductive care. And the doctor said, you know, I can't treat you because you're a lesbian, and, you know, you being a lesbian is against my beliefs, so I'm not going to treat you. And so she did not want to give her the OBGYN care that she needed. So we were very successful in that California case, and although it was a California-specific case, it sets a very important precedent that doctors cannot deny access to health care because of their religious beliefs. And we also had a very similar case like that in Washington, which is, I mean, incredibly egregious, where the plaintiff needed prescription drugs, and the doctor learned that he was gay and said, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to treat you, I'm not going to give you this prescription because I don't believe that I'm in homosexuality. So these are the kind of issues we're coming across at Lambda Legal, and there's very strong federal and a lot of state law to protect people from being access to care because either they're HIV or they're LGBT. So those are some really prime examples of what we're doing. And if anybody's interested in our healthcare survey, you can just go on our website, and it's really wonderful, and there's a very specific section that deals with LGBT older adults.
Thank you so much. Obviously, as Americans are getting older, there's a big concern in the issues of long-term care. I know there are some special concerns for LGBT people and those with HIV, and some issues have arisen in this area as well. Can you talk a little bit about what people should know about long-term care?
This is a really interesting question. In the last year or so, a really hot topic has been what are the issues for LGBT older adults who are trying to access long-term care? Lambda Legal, along with several LGBT organizations, including non-LGBT organizations such as the National Senior Citizens Law Center, conducted a survey called Stories from the Field, looking at discrimination in long-term care for LGBT older adults. It wasn't a scientific survey, but it was really an opportunity for us to kind of really blanket out and send out the survey all across the country to as many people as we could to get a sense of what are some of the issues that LGBT older adults are facing in accessing long-term care, where is this happening in the country, and what can we do about it. So around 800 people responded to that survey, and what we learned is that 328 people in that survey reported instances of mistreatment in long-term care facilities. What's challenging about discrimination in long-term care facilities is that state laws vary as to what protections there are for discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. What's really unique about this particular issue in terms of nursing home or nursing home facilities is there's an actual federal law called the Federal Nursing Home Reform Act, and this is a law that really isn't widely used, but it's an incredibly strong federal statute that's essentially a bill of rights for all residents who live in long-term care facilities. And essentially what the law says is any resident that lives in a skilled nursing facility, which also means facilities that have beds that a person may just stay in for a temporary time. So when you're talking about nursing home care, it's not always somebody who's in the nursing home indefinitely. So that also widens the breadth of people who are affected that are in nursing homes. But the Nursing Home Reform Act is basically a Bill of Rights saying, nursing facility, you have to treat everybody with dignity, respect. You cannot forcefully isolate residents. You have to ensure that they are receiving the highest quality of care and have mental well-being is promoted while they're in your care. So as you can hear, this language is incredibly broad and really rich in that it's not specific to race or sex or gender. If any resident that's in a facility has to be respected and these rights are applied. So this is one thing I really hope that people will take away, is that if you are in a field or if you have family or friends or anything, like any sort of relationship in that sense, and that person's entering a long-term care facility, there is a federal law to protect them from abuse, neglect, discrimination, and isolation. And that's a lot of what we've been hearing that is going on in nursing homes, forceful isolation, for example. Another thing about long-term care is recently the HUD, the Housing Urban Development, have clarified the regulations in terms of discrimination in housing, and actually the federal statute is the Fair Housing Act. And just last year, the HUD clarified that discrimination in housing on a federal level, discrimination based on sex, can also be considered discrimination based on gender identity and expression. And this is for a federal Fair Housing Act, which is also incredibly important because a nursing home may qualify and likely qualify for housing under the Fair Housing Act. So that is another tool that can be used if there's discrimination in long-term care and access to long-term care. You can also apply the Fair Housing Act. And it doesn't mean that you have to go litigate or, you know, open a lawsuit. It can be something as simple as writing an advocacy letter or something of that effect saying, you know, my ex-person, my spouse, my partner, my brother, my sister, they deserve access to your facility, and this is the law that should apply. And I just want to give a quick example of a case that Lambda Legal dealt with. It's called the Frankie case, and this was out of Arkansas. And this Mr. Frankie was around 78 years old. He was HIV positive, and he moved to Arkansas to be closer to his daughter. He was accepted into an assisted living facility, no problem. He filled out all the paperwork. He disclosed his HIV status. He moved all of his stuff in. And then that same day he moved in, his daughter was hanging out with him. A nurse looked in his file and said, oh, my gosh, he has HIV, called up the daughter and said, I'm sorry, but you have to get your father out of here right now, and evicted him from the assisted living facility. And this happens quite often, and fortunately for us, We litigated this case. We brought claims under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Fair Housing Act, and also other statutes under Arkansas Civil Rights Laws, and we prevailed, although Mr. Frankie found another home that was more accommodating. But this is just another example of how we can use federal laws and to some extent state laws to ensure that there's access to long-term care. So we can use the Fair Housing Act and the ADAA in cases of HIV. And we can also use the Federal Nursing Home Reform Act for things like abuse, neglect, and discrimination.
Thank you so much for that. One way we can all protect ourselves, I know, is by having a will. Could you advise people on those issues around having a will and how the community can further protect itself?
Sure, and I know Thomas is going to go into a lot more of this in terms of the documents that you need and the life planning documents. So I know that this teleconference was life, financial planning, and I guess I'm doing the life part. And then Thomas is going to do the financial planning part, which is also, part of life. But in terms of a will, what's really interesting is that a will is something that is very important to the extent that once you pass away, you've identified somebody who your possessions will go to, okay? And the best way for me to describe the importance of a will is a case that Lambda Legal dealt with called the Ramsell case. It was based in New York. Mr. Ramsell had a will. and he names his spouse, his legal spouse, as the distributee in his will. And when he passed away, what happened was some long-lost relatives came out of nowhere and said, you know what, my brother was not legally married. That marriage is not valid. Why is that important? So in this instance, Mr. Ramsell and his husband, Mr. Levy, were legally married. And if you're legally married, then you are considered a distributee, which means that you have a right, you're the only person that has a right to contest the will, barring very limited exceptions. Therefore, no family members can kind of come up out of nowhere and say, hey, I'm sorry that this isn't correct. So essentially what they were trying to do is push the legal spouse away and say, we actually want more under the will. Because they were left money under the will, but they wanted to challenge it because they wanted more money. So in this instance, it was very good that Mr. Ramsell did name his spouse on the will, and we did prevail at that being a legal marriage. And this was before we legalized the marriages of same-sex couples. All that being said, and Thomas can chime in when I'm done, is that the importance of legal marriage in terms of the purposes of wills is incredibly important, because if you die intestate, which means if you die without a will and you're legally married, the law kicks in to the extent that your legal spouse will inherit a certain amount and has an automatic right to inherit. And that's something that cannot be taken away. And that's one reason why, deciding whether or not you want to get married is a very personal issue, but there's some very strong legal protections, such as if you die intestate and you're a spouse, you get automatic inheritance, and that's one example.
Well, thank you, Natalie, so much for your incredible insight into the issues that are surrounding LGBT seniors and people living with HIV, and for the work that Lambda Legal is doing around these areas. Now I'd like to turn to Tom, who is going to discuss some life and financial planning tools that LGBT people and those with HIV can use to protect themselves. Welcome, Thomas, and thank you for participating in tonight's call.
Thank you for having me. Before the first question, can I just take a moment to introduce myself? My name is Tom Siaka. I'm an attorney in New York City. I am a trust and estates attorney and a trust and estates litigator, and I'm licensed in New York, New Jersey, and Florida. I'm actually participating in this call with Lambda Legal on behalf of SAGE, which is the nation's oldest and largest LGBT Senior Services Center. And I've been a volunteer lawyer there for the last 6 or 7 years, running a pro bono legal clinic for older LGBT adults who have legal issues. So I'd like to share some of those with you. Thank you for having me.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was just going to start talking about some of the medical and financial planning documents that it's important for members of our community to have. Natalie was very good to tell us wills, but keep in mind that a will is just a document that takes over upon one's death. It's very important to have some documents in place in order to help us during our lifetime, specifically when it comes to surrogate decision making, which basically means, look, if there comes a time when I can't make a decision for myself, whether it be a financial decision or a medical decision, these are the people that I want to make those decisions for me. And basically, those documents come in a few flavors. First, looking at financial matters. Most people who are into this type of planning, which is recommended with some caveats, which I'll discuss in a minute, opt to have a power of attorney. A power of attorney is a document whereby you appoint someone to make a business or financial decision. And everyone makes business and financial decisions, whether you're a Rockefeller or whether you are on public benefit. Let me give you an example of some things that would be covered by a power of attorney: the ability to file a tax return, the ability to apply for public benefits such as Medicare or Medicaid or disability if you are in a catastrophic accident, the ability to renew a lease the ability to manage your bank accounts to make sure all of your bills are paid. Things that we do as individuals every single day, it may be important for someone to do those for us at a certain time. These documents are very, very careful. However, the caveat that I give with these is that the person that you appoint under a power of attorney is somebody who's going to have almost unlimited and unchecked control over your bank account. So it should be someone that you trust implicitly. Here in New York State, for example, when the legislature redid our power of attorney statute, they increased the warning on the front page of the document from a quarter of the page to two-thirds of the front page. And basically what the warning says is, look, this is someone who can help you out in a pinch, but be careful because this person can also rob you blind. So it's very important that you pick somebody in order to make these decisions. It's important that it be someone that you trust implicitly. Looking now at the area of medical decisions, basically what I'd like to talk about is three documents that we may find interesting. And these documents vary by state to state in by what they're called. However, the concepts are uniform throughout. Let's talk about medical decision making. And the document that I want to talk about is a healthcare proxy, which some states refer to as a medical power of attorney. A healthcare proxy is a document whereby a person appoints an agent to make a medical decision for them if there comes a time when he or she cannot make that decision for him or herself. So, for example, if I am in a hospital and I'm being kept alive artificially, I've just suffered a catastrophic accident, my agent can make the decision whether or not to continue or discontinue that treatment. My agent can make decisions as to whether I should stay in the hospital or whether I should go into a hospice or back to my home in order to receive comfort care, which is very, very important to some people, and it should be important to you. Under the laws of most states, your doctors are required by law to listen to you so that you can meaningfully communicate with them, and your agent has no power until such time as you're unable to meaningfully communicate. The example I gave before was a, quote, pull the plug type of situation, and everyone's familiar with that term and what that means, but it really can mean so much more. For example, there may be times when I cannot meaningfully communicate with my doctors, and it may be necessary for someone to make a medical decision for me. For example, maybe I'm suffering from moderate to severe Alzheimer's dementia. I'm not hooked up to a machine in a hospital, but I cannot meaningfully communicate with my doctors, and someone needs to consent to a dental surgery. A healthcare proxy is something that can allow you to do that. The next document that I'd like to talk about is what's called a living will. A living will is very similar to a healthcare proxy in that it deals with medical decision making. However, it's more limited. Remember, the healthcare proxy will address all decisions. And it appoints an agent to make a decision for you. Doctor, if I can't communicate with you, please listen to my agent X. The living will is just a statement of your wishes, and it is limited to artificial or heroic measures to keep you alive. If I suffer an injury or an illness from which my recovery is incredibly unlikely, I either do or do not want things like CPR, tube feeding, mechanical respiration. Maybe I want the administration of pain medication to make me comfortable, even if it hastens my death. These are things that can be included in that living will. A living will is also very good for two reasons. First, it gives some directions to the agents on your healthcare proxy. If I need a partner or my son or my daughter or whoever as my agent on my healthcare proxy, hopefully it's going to be difficult for her to make that decision as to whether or not to continue my life support. Hopefully the agent has not been waiting to pull the plug on me in these many years. Having my wishes in writing will often make it easier for them to make the decision. Secondly, if all of my agents are unavailable to serve, either because they're just unwilling to make the decision and maybe in a common accident, under the laws of all 50 states, a valid living will is sufficient to, in order to terminate life-sustaining measures, if that's what one wants. On those two documents, the healthcare proxy and the living will, let me just tell most of you that they are available for free in most states through your state's Department of Health website or your state's Attorney General's office. If these are documents you're interested in, but you are not in a position to pay for legal services, often download them for free with instructions and really advocate for yourself, which is a wonderful thing. The one final document that I want to talk about is something called HIPAA and a HIPAA medical release. Some of you may have heard of HIPAA either by name or if you've been to your doctor's office in the last 10 years. Incident of seeing a doctor for the first time, the doctor often makes you sign a receipt saying that you received a copy of his or her privacy statement. That's HIPAA. HIPAA is a federal statute that basically tells doctors, hospitals, nursing homes, any healthcare providers that they are not to distribute your personal, private health information without your consent, which sounds like a good thing. The problem is, and this really bites us in our community, is that very often we may be in a relationship or married or partnered with somebody who does not share the same last name as we do. So if I'm in an accident and my partner shows up at the hospital, look at him and say, you have a different last name. Who are you and why should we talk to you? You can very, very easily overcome this by signing a HIPAA release, And a HIPAA release is something that's signed by you before a notary public, and it's instructions to any doctor or hospital or nursing home that's treating you to release all of your confidential medical information to the person or persons of your choosing. It can be a partner, it can be my best friend, it can be a neighbor, whoever I want, as opposed to my family members who may or may not be on the scene, and I may or may not want to have that information. Those are the documents that I think are important on the life on the lifetime side of things.
Tom, can you speak a little bit to a funeral directive, as I think it's known in some states, or the appointment of an agent to control your remains, that particular document?
Sure, I'd be pleased to. When we're talking about the disposition of your remains, we're talking about what happens to your dead body, to your cadaver. The types of decisions that would be encompassed in this sort of thing would be things such as, am I to be buried or cremated? If I'm buried, where am I buried? Am I buried next to my family or next to my partner? If I'm cremated, who gets the ashes? Is there going to be a religious service, a non-religious service, or no service at all? Or is going to be harvested for donation, things like that. But in the laws of all 50 states, there are certain people who have the authority to make that decision on behalf once you are dead. And those people are all biological relatives or spouses. For example, here in New York, first it would be your spouse, followed by your children, then your parents, your siblings, nieces and nephews, and so on down the list. The important thing here is twofold. Those may not be the people that I want to make that decision. Or maybe my spouse is the person that I would like to make that decision, but my spouse is not my spouse in the eyes of the state in which I live. Maybe you came up to New York or California or Massachusetts to get married, and you went back to your home state where there is a constitutional amendment banning the recognition of an out-of-state same-sex marriage. By signing a document like this, it is very, very easy to make your wishes known, and it can save you a lot of problems. Believe me, as someone who has been in the surrogate's courts to get a temporary restraining order to prevent the burial of someone who always wanted to be cremated, it is not what you want to do 24 or 48 hours after a loved one dies. Again, this is just an example of how we can advocate for ourselves and make our wishes known.
Can I ask a question, Thomas? So in terms of one thing that comes up in the transgender community is, for example, I want to be buried according to my gender expression. So I don't want to be in a suit, for example, you know, somebody. Can you put that in your funeral directive on how I want my body to be presented? Because this has absolutely been an issue that has come up in family members who don't recognize an individual's gender identity. Say, you know what, we're not going to respect that, absolutely not.
And absolutely. How you're going to be dressed, if there's an open casket, the name that's going to appear on the gravestone, whether it's the birth name or the chosen name of the deceased individual, are all things that can be there. And really, you can put anything in this document with some limited exceptions. All 50 states have rules concerning the handlings of decedent's remains. So, for example, if I wanted to be cremated and have my ashes scattered in Central Park, technically, that's illegal. That is an illegal way to dispose of a dead body, although it happens probably every day of the week. You know, those are things that you might not want that level of detail as far as what happens to your ashes. What you might want to do is say, I direct the cremation of my remains, and please give the remains to my friend Betty, and Betty will dispose of them in accordance with my wishes, period.
Right, and these aren't really issues that we talk much about in our community. I mean, we don't like to talk about the end of life. But Lambda Legal had a case, it's called the Barone case, where this woman and her partner were together for many, many, many years. Her partner died suddenly, but before she died, she told her partner, you know, please, on my tombstone, can you say this is to my beloved partner, mother, and daughter? And essentially, the surviving partner said, of course, of course. And then when the partner passed away, the surviving partner went to the funeral home and said, this is what we want etched on the tombstone. And they said, absolutely not. We're not going to put the partner on the tombstone. And we actually had to litigate this case. This was many, many years ago. But all the document that Thomas is speaking of, the funeral directive, could absolutely have changed the circumstances because, you know, you're going to be in mourning and having to deal with ignorance and bigotry so shortly after something so terrible has happened is not something you want to do.
I mean, and it's not always about the ignorance and bigotry. Sometimes it's just, you know, state law, which is often fueled by ignorance and bigotry, unfortunately. Right. But I had a case once where it was right after I graduated law school. Natalie, I told you this story, and I went to go work for a firm, and being the openly gay attorney, they assigned the lesbian couple to me, I guess because no one else knew how to deal with them, which was unfortunate. And on my second day of work, one of them died. And it was terrible because the deceased woman had always wanted to be cremated. She had made it very clear to her partner over the years she wanted to be cremated. Under New York state law, there are only certain people who can authorize a cremation, a spouse or a domestic partner. They had never married and they had never registered as domestic partners here, and then all the biological relatives. The issue here wasn't that the partner was fighting with the family members. The issue was there were no family members. She had never had any children. Her parents were deceased. She was an only child, so there were no brothers, sisters, and nieces and nephews. And it was me and my client at the public administrator's office in Manhattan screaming at bureaucrats trying to get them to cremate her deceased partner of 40 years. And it was just something that she should not have had to deal with. So, again, the more you can advocate for yourself, the more you can make your wishes known, the better.
And that document is a separate document from the will, that you don't want to put those directions in the will. Is that correct?
It doesn't hurt to put them in the will. The problem is that a will is not a will until a court validates it by admitting it to what's called probate. Probate is a legal term that means that the court stamps it and says everything was done correctly, the deceased had capacity, there were the correct number of witnesses and notaries, this is a valid will. In the most efficient surrogates courts or circuit courts in the country, the minimum wait time that you will have to probate a will from the day you file the papers in court is 2 weeks. So you really, you know, excuse me for being crude, but you really don't want to be kept on ice for 2 weeks if there's going to be a litigated issue. And as Natalie mentioned, all of those distant biological relatives can come out of the woodwork and challenge that will and delay its probate by weeks, months, or even years in some cases. Having a separate writing is important.
The body may have already been disposed of by the time someone gets around to looking at the will.
Correct. The one other thing that I'll tell people who are concerned about this is that to the extent you are adamant that this is what's going to happen to your remains, and obviously people feel very strongly about this, you can prepay for your funeral in all 50 states by going into the funeral parlor of your choice. And you can arrange and make decisions, burial versus cremation, how the body's going to be dressed, the name on the tombstone, things like that. Pay it all in advance. If you do that, you have a binding contract with the service providers. And you know that your next of kin or your friends or your family of choice are not going to be having an issue dealing with someone's religious or political beliefs because you have personally met with that vendor, entered into the contract with them. And I have a small handful of clients who have done that for just that reason.
There's one other document that I wanted to ask you about, Tom, and that's a hospital visitation document that sets out your desire to allow certain people to visit you in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And this is something that is a state law issue, so it varies among all 50 states. For example, in New York, it is first your spouse or your registered domestic partner, because even though we do have marriage equality here in New York, we also have a domestic partnership registry, followed by children, grandchildren, parents, brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, that whole crowd. If you want someone else to be able to have priority visitation, which can be important, for example, if suffering a serious injury or illness, and I'm in the intensive care unit where only one person can come and sit with me and visit me. In that situation, I'm a big fan of committing it to writing and making your wishes known. This is the person who I want to have priority visitation. However, it's very important that the recipient of that priority have the document. So if you're going to the hospital and you are visiting someone and you're their first choice, it's very important that you have that document in hand. Otherwise, just telling a hospital administrator that somebody signed something is not so good. And then obviously, you know, depending on where you are in, you know, around the country, there are people who are more sensitive to our community's issues and people who unfortunately are not.
Could you expand on that?
Sorry, Cindy, can I add something to that?
Sure.
And Landon Legal, I'm sure many people know the Langdon case. And this was a case that happened in Florida where Janice Langdon's partner and her family were about to go on a cruise. And her partner got very ill and had an aneurysm. And essentially they went to the hospital, and Janice, you know, had all the documents, but she didn't have them on her person. and the hospital said would not let her visit her partner, her spouse, and the kids. The whole family was at the hospital, and the person working said, "I'm sorry, this is an she didn't say I'm sorry. So this is an anti-gay state, and you don't have a right to see your partner." And this was in a hospital in Florida. Eventually, you know, her spouse passed away, and Janice did get some time to see her spouse, but it took more time than it should have. And as a result of this, just the fury over this really kind of went viral across the country. And the Obama administration recognized the discrimination that Ms. Langley faced in such a critical time. And so just this year, new federal regulations were passed which spell out hospital visitation rights, that all hospitals who accept Medicaid or Medicare must abide by, and specifically they have to outline the visitation policy and let individuals know that they can designate, as Thomas said, who they want to be their visitors. And since this is such a new federal regulation, of course, it will take time for people to recognize that this is a right that they have, and also for the hospitals to exercise this right and to realize that they have to comply with federal law because this is a federal regulation. So Thomas is absolutely right that you should create a document designating who you want as your visitor when you're in a hospital, but there's also a federal protection out there now, recently enacted in January 2011, which says that you cannot discriminate against people based on sexual orientation and other categories, gender identity, those people who wish to visit in a hospital. That's very, very important.
Could you, Tom, would you just expand a little bit on who ought to have copies of the documents and where they ought to be kept and that sort of thing so that people know what to do about having the documents in the hands of the people that can actually are named as agents?
Sure. As far as the healthcare proxy, I'm making sure that the principal, the person who's signing the document, has a copy. All of the agents have one. So if I name three agents and they're going to serve first, second, third, all three of them have a copy of it. I also tell my clients to give a copy to their doctor or to their doctors if they have more than one doctor. Doctors love receiving healthcare proxies, if for no other reason that it is sort of a crib notes version of everyone's emergency contact information. My doctor has my healthcare proxy. If I'm crossing the street and I get hit by the crosstown bus and the ambulance peels me off the sidewalk and brings me to the hospital, what's going to happen? The hospital's going to dig through my wallet for hopefully just my health insurance card. They're going to find out who my primary care physician is, and they're going to reach out to him. And he can very easily fax over a copy of that document. I'm also a big fan of scanning things. Those of you who are computer savvy, you know, if you can scan something and then upload it to a cloud or something like Dropbox, which a lot of people have now with their iPhones and iPads and things like that, you can really access them remotely from anywhere in the world. So if you're on vacation and all of a sudden there's a catastrophe, if you can get to a 24-hour computer coffee shop, you can print out a copy of your healthcare proxy. The same thing for all of the other documents. You know, it's very important that the agents have them and that the people making the decisions have the statements concerning what your wishes are.
And I just want to also add, there is a website, and it's a service called the U.S. Living Will Registry. And this is a national service that's offered. It's fee-based, but it's a seemingly reasonable fee, and it allows you to store your advance directives in a national registry, and the company will give you a card that if you give to the hospital or your doctor, it comes up with your information. So it's basically like a pocket card, and then it will have your advance directives on it. So you can register your advance directives and get this little pocket card, which you can take and also give to somebody else, and it's really mobile, and they plug in certain numbers in their computer, and then your information just pops up. So it's a really another option if it's something that is, affordable it is something available. And the website is uslivingwillregistry.com.
Thank you. We're about out of time. I have one other question that I'm going to pose to you. It's a very there's no quick and short answer to this question, so if you, the two of you, could just give a very broad, general overview of the answer to this question, given that we have, I think we could probably spend an entire hour on it. So the question is to, the person wants you to elaborate on the purpose of long-term disability care insurance. And in the event of debilitation, what does a person need to do to protect him or herself and spouse from bearing the cost of long-term care? And also, can someone with HIV qualify for Medicaid assistance without becoming destitute? So do either one of you want to speak to that question?
Natalie, do you want to talk about the insurance part, and I'll talk about the Medicaid part?
I thought maybe you could talk about the insurance part, and I could talk about the Medicaid.
Let's do that. So long-term care insurance is an insurance policy, just like any other life insurance policy, just like any other life insurance policy that one could buy, life insurance, health insurance, homeowners insurance. It protects you in case a stated event occurs. And here we're talking about your disability. Long-term care policies are something that is, they're all very specific, and you have to be a very smart shopper and see what it is that you're buying. For example, some of them will only cover nursing home care, and that is not people's first choice generally. Generally, people would like to stay in their own homes to the extent that they are able to do so. And you know, going into a nursing home is really the last resort. If a long-term care insurance policy that you open up your checkbook for and start paying premiums isn't going to cover that, you have to look into it and make sure that they are. Whenever you're dealing with long-term care insurance, if you are not purchasing it as a member of a group, the provider has the right to ask medical questions. And medical questions, you know, chronic illnesses, there may even be blood tests involved with some. And most insurers, in fact, I can't think of any that will underwrite someone who is HIV positive, regardless of their current viral load or their T cell count or how well they are overall as far as their general health. If you have the opportunity to purchase it as part of a group, for example, if you work for a large employer, you might be able to just become a member of the group, and when you're dealing with a group, very often they are not allowed to ask medical questions. So that can be a way to get affordable long-term care. However, it is expensive. The good news is that some states, like New York, offer a partial income tax deduction for a percentage of the premiums that you pay on your long-term care insurance. And if you have questions on that, you can consult your tax preparer. Probably not the best time of year right now to pick up the phone and call him or her, but in about a month, you should consult with them and take their advice and see whether or not you can get a deduction for it.
Now, in terms of the Medicaid aspect, as Cindy said, this is such a complex and weedy issue. And so the short of it is, under the Medicaid laws for access to long-term care, there's something called the spousal impoverishment protection, which applies to different sex spouses who are married. And the purpose of this law was to ensure that the spouse who stays at home, the community spouse, if their husband or wife enters long-term care, the federal government wanted to ensure that they didn't become impoverished, as the person who asked this question obviously is very concerned about. So the person staying at home has these federal protections, granted by the federal government, saying if your husband or wife goes into long-term care, we're going to make sure that you are not impoverished. We're not going to put a lien on your house while you live there. We're not going to recover your estate. And you're only going to be allowed to keep a certain number of assets, up to $113,000. and certain income. The problem in our community is that because Medicaid, it is a state and federal program, so that because of DOMA, states are not under any obligation required to give these same spousal impoverishment protections to same-sex spouses. However, that being said, states do have an enormous amount of discretion. So the question is, well, how can I ensure that, you know, I'm not impoverished if I have to enter long-term care, or your partner's not impoverished? It really just depends on the state that you live in. If the state recognizes that if person A goes into long-term care and their partner's at home, but person A was the breadwinner, obviously person B is going to suffer an undue hardship. Maybe they will no longer have an income, or maybe they'll have to sell assets. Therefore, the government can take that into account and say, well, we don't want to impoverish you, so we're going to allow the person entering long-term care to actually transfer assets without a penalty to their spouse who's staying at home. And that's a very simple of it. So essentially, for LGBT couples or individuals, you would have to spend down to $2,000 to enter long-term care. So essentially, you have to be impoverished in order to enter long-term care, and Medicaid will pay for it. But states do have discretion to recognize the undue hardship that might occur if you are in a relationship to the person who's staying at home. So I'd urge whomever asked that question, if you feel free to email me, and we can talk about it. I don't know what state you live in or what your situation is, but there's a lot of statewide advocacy really trying to push states to exercise their discretion and apply the spousal impoverishment protection to same-sex relationships, whether they're legal marriages or whether they're just codependent, interrelated relationships. I don't think that we're trying to stay away from just focusing on marriage and just looking at the relationship as a whole to figure out if an undue hardship would take place. And actually, the Medicaid office issued a statewide, not directive, but sort of, hey, all statewide Medicaid officers, just know that you have this discretion. So when you come across an issue, when you have LGBT, a couple, you can use your discretion to exercise undue hardship and not penalize the person staying at home and the person living in long-term care. So I hope that clears. Thomas, if you have anything else to clarify that, please, by all means, do.
No, I think it was very, very thorough.
Well, our time's up. I want to thank everyone for participating tonight. Thank you so much to Natalie and to Thomas for all of their wonderful information. Thank you again to the Anita Mae Rosenstein Foundation for generously underwriting this program. And thank you in particular to our participants for being here. I'm sorry that we were not able to get to all of the questions. If you continue to have a question, you can call our hotline. You can call the number that I'm going to give you is just our the number at headquarters, which is 212-809-8585, and ask to be directed to the help desk. And if Natalie said that the person who submitted that last question, if you want to send another email to the email address that you sent that to, libertycircle@lambdalegal.org, I will forward that question on to Natalie. So, again, thank you, everyone, for participating, and good night.
And for folks that actually choose to call the help desk, just mention that you were on this call so that I will know. And Thomas will know, so that would be really helpful.
Great. Well, good night, everyone.